Our first speaker will be Professor William Sells of the Black Studies Department at Seton Hall University.
Thank you, Ron. Malcolm X's early ideological development is squarely within the nationalist wing of the black intellectual tradition. His early training occurred within the context of the family, but two important indigenous institutions in the black community were crucial here, the Black Church and the Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association and the Valley Political Organization. At maturity, Malcolm X's ideological training continued, first on the streets and later with jailhouse intellectuals. He was subsequently mentored by Elijah Muhammad. The Harlem street corner nationalists taught Malcolm, as did the radical black intelligentsia. Last, he became a disciple of the continental Pan-Africanists like Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Toure, and Gamal Abdel Nasser. Malcolm's Pan-African internationalism was augmented by the revolutionary nationalism and socialism of the African freedom fighters and third world socialist diplomats he met on his several trips to Africa. Groups like the African National Congress, the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, the revolutionaries in the Portuguese colonies, and important diplomatic figures like Muhammad Rahman Babu of Zanzibar, Armando Antaldo, ambassador from Cuba to Ghana, the Chinese ambassador in Ghana in 1964, Wang Hua, and Tahir Kaihid, with whom Malcolm had a long conversation, the Algerian ambassador. Malcolm X's political ideology was also molded within the institutional context of an insurgent movement, the civil rights movement. At the end of his life, his institutional links were squarely within the African-American tradition of Pan-Africanism. Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity was both a civil rights and human rights organization and an Afro-American Unity was both a civil rights and human rights organization and an integral part of the organizational elaboration that created the Organization of African Unity. Malcolm emerged as a leader in the African-American freedom struggle when that struggle was on the rise. As the civil rights movement spread out of the South, that struggle activated the stratum of ghettoized black working and street people and projected this stratum to central stage. These people were formerly outside of the existing organizational context of the civil rights movement, and Malcolm was also a human rights leader with no formal organizational position within the civil rights movement. Malcolm spoke, however, the venerated tradition of African-American nationalism, and he spoke it in the language and style of the largest and most agitated stratum in the black community. Malcolm's ideological intervention created a space within the movement which allowed urban working class black folks and street people to articulate their mood and their agenda. This fact alone established Malcolm as one of the two most important African-American leaders in the 1960s. Malcolm X recognized the reality, too, which Martin Delaney earlier referred to in 1852 when he said, and I'll quote him very briefly, "The claims of no people, according to established policy and usage, are respected by any nation until they are presented in a national capacity," end quote. To legitimize the black liberation struggle in international forums, Malcolm X recognized that African Americans had to speak with one dominant voice. It is within the context of the black united front that the struggle for ideological unity and organizational cooperation takes place. It's also important to recognize that Malcolm X, at the end of his life, was trying to construct a new paradigm of African-American liberation. This, he recognized, was not an individual but a collective endeavor which could only take place within the context of a black united front. It is within the organizational context of the black united front that the ideological struggle would advance and a new paradigm of liberation could be fashioned. The United Front concept of Malcolm's last and most intellectually mature period is embodied in his approach to form the OAAU. The Organization of Afro-American Unity model was based on the concept of a black united front with all black membership, with special emphasis on building up cooperation between middle class blacks and urban ghetto street people. One of Malcolm's most important intellectual contributions was to criticize middle class civil rights leadership and call it back into the service of the masses. Here he resurrected a sense of Du Bois's talented 10th concept, grounded not in elitism, but in the concept of a black united front with the agenda of the urban masses in the forefront. The geographical focus of Malcolm's efforts were both national and international. The agenda of the organization was anti-imperialist, pro-socialist, that is in the Pan-Africanist sense. It was a human rights agenda, and have reflected the priority concerns of ghetto inhabitants. Its program was to be designed to test the limits of reform through independent black politics. This united front sought out Pan Africanists and other international allies to carry its program in the international forums. It would accept no strings attached support from whites. Self-defense as opposed to nonviolence was to be its orientation, and revolutionary options were to be seriously studied. Grassroots leadership was encouraged, and democratic decision-making the norm. Women were accorded full equality with men in participation, leadership, and decision-making. This was a drastic departure from the role of women in the Nation of Islam. Malcolm X did not run into existence. His OAAU was too weak to continue his work after his assassination, and the movement itself was subject to divisive tendencies. With a few notable exceptions, the dominant strategic motion in the black community since Malcolm X has come from those not in the nationalist tradition, but in the militant assimilationist tradition of Martin Luther King. These folks ascribe to an ethnic assimilationist model. They made their peace with black power by defining it as no more than a traditional strategy of European ethnic groups applied to the black problematic. Politically, they advocated block voting within the auspices of the Democratic Party. They believed that this would increase black elected representation in the South and in America's cities. They felt that the resources obtained in this fashion, patronage, influence, and the control of government contracts would be, as for previous European immigrants, major sources of African-American empowerment. Economically, the construction of a civic-minded, philanthropically disposed middle class of black entrepreneurs would be the center of gravity around which black community development would occur, they felt. The general orientation here was to see the struggle shifting from the arena of protest to the electoral arena, from tactics appropriate to those frozen out of the polity to those who now had access to the polity. In fact, this represented an argument for extending leadership credentials to black politicians and the black middle class generally. The masses of black people were to give up the protest option and concentrate on expanding their voting power so as to increase the number of black insiders who would then seek resources on behalf of the masses. This tendency was successful in increasing the black electorate and black elected officials at all levels of government. It's been responsible for the establishment of the Congressional Black Caucus, the Joint Center for Political Studies, Trans-Africa. Almost all the largest American cities have experienced the election of a black mayor. There's a greatly expanded African-American presence in the Democratic Party. And the high point of this achievement was the presidential campaign of Jesse Jackson in 1988 and the election of Ron Brown as Democratic National Chairperson. However, the black electoral politics championed by the heirs of Dr. King has failed to ameliorate the pressing needs of the masses of ghettoized black people. In addition, it's not been able to forge a consensus in the black community on the question of which classes' agenda should receive priority in the construction of a black united front. Today, this question is even more complex than it was 26 years ago. Our community is more economically skewed today around the divergent life chances of the growing but small black middle class and the burgeoning so-called black underclass. The established civil rights and electoral political leadership in the African-American community has eschewed militant protests, but has not developed either an electoral strategy or a way of administering cities which effectively answers the Reagan-Bush reaction. It has been impotent in the face of the rising material deprivation of the 1980s. Just as important, it has failed neither to bolster racial pride and dignity among blacks or garner respect from the race for whites. The present African-American civil and political leadership has attempted to forge a united front, but with its own class agenda in the forefront. Correspondingly, it has demobilized rather than mobilized the masses for liberation. Consequently, elements of the masses looking for a way to fight back have fallen into the hands of lumpen demagogues, retread infantile leftists, narrow black nationalists, and a sort of careerist looking for an electoral constituency. This occurred at a time when a new social force, black youth, and the breakdance rap culture created was re-energizing the black working class. Taking its cue from its counterparts in South Africa, this new social force sought some social groundedness and intellectual justification for its anger and militancy. This need in the youth engendered a renewed interest in Malcolm X and the Pan-African nationalist and international tradition of which he was the most elegant spokesman. We must recognize also, however, that the bankruptcy of civil rights leaders and black elected officials has created a window of opportunity for Republican conservatism and the far right to inject their divisive ideological orientation into the debate on which way forward to black liberation. I'm going to pass over some of my comments in the interest of time and move on to some observations about the Judge Thomas phenomena and the neoconservative motion that he represents. Okay. Judge Thomas and the neoconservatives elicit sympathy among some African Americans. Aspects of their ideology reflect the respect for self-help also seen in the economic nationalism of leaders like Booker T. Washington, Elijah Muhammad, and Minister Louis Farrakhan. Black neoconservatism exploits the aversion that black people feel for the opportunism and duplicity that the liberalism of the Democratic Party has reflected too often of late. It directs its criticism at an African-American political and civil rights leadership with which the masses of black people are quite angry and disgusted. Sometimes this leadership inadvertently itself articulates aspects of the neoconservative agenda, and therefore it is in no position to launch a thoroughgoing criticism of black neoconservatism. The established African-American political and civil rights leadership has put economics in command of politics in order to disguise two things. First, the degree to which it has been co-opted into the government corporate apparatus in the field of electoral politics and the public bureaucracy, and therefore the fact that it cannot lead a political campaign which in the first instance would be largely directed against itself. Second, in the face of worsening economic crisis, it is unwilling to acknowledge and lead the struggle against capital, which if successful would eliminate its special station in the black community. Instead, it makes common cause with the neoconservatives and offers anachronistic self-help and economic nationalist policies of the Booker T. Washington era. In addition, some black people mistakenly feel that Judge Thomas should not have been publicly criticized or held accountable because this amounted to tearing down a black man who had achieved power and respect in a white world. His neoconservative supporters were therefore able to exploit this sentiment and portray Judge Thomas as a victim, especially when he was accused of sexual harassment by Professor Anita Hill. The black neoconservatives are creatures of political forces outside of the black community. They serve the Reagan-Bushite reaction and thus are an alien force in our community. They stand outside of the African-American protest tradition. The present crisis has had a tremendous negative impact on the black petty bourgeoisie. It has pushed many of them closer to the black masses. Malcolm X recognized that in constructing the Black United Front, the movement had to compete for the allegiance of the black petty bourgeoisie. He recognized that this strata was an important social force in the black community, which had a revolutionary potential. Malcolm X welcomed the black petty bourgeoisie into the Black United Front. And to reinforce this point, I'd just like to quote him briefly in the context of my limited time. Malcolm said in 1964, the black middle class in its attempt to protect the crumbs a white man gives will try at the same time to deceive him. This is the most acrobatic of Negroes. We have to revolutionize his thinking. He will come around when he realizes that he's barking up the wrong tree. End quote. Malcolm X is an attractive leadership figure to struggling middle-class black folks. He's as attractive to them as he is to the hip-hop street youth. Can you imagine what kind of social force would emerge if the talents of the black petty bourgeoisie were hitched to the militant energy of the black youth protest culture, all led by the insights of Malcolm X? The ruling class can imagine its consequences, and they are scared. Therefore, they advance the likes of Justice Clarence Thomas and General Colin Powell, and for the first time, give them real, not symbolic power, and membership in the nation's political elite. The power and prestige of their positions imbue their reactionary ideology with the legitimacy in the black community it heretofore could not endure. They hope to entice the black petty bourgeoisie away from an alliance with the black masses and dilute the powerful leadership image of Malcolm X. Their goal is to derail the process of rebuilding the Black United Front. The black neoconservative presence attempts to shift the debate within the black community to the right. It says a debate between liberalism and conservatism is the important debate. In so doing, it attempts to isolate the left pole right. It says a debate between liberalism and conservatism is the important debate. In so doing, it attempts to isolate the left pole and the radical protest tradition and banish it from the minds of the African-American masses. As we need to chart which way forward, this reactionary ideological offensive projects to center stage a debate already long since had in the history of the black protest tradition, that between Washington and Du Bois or between Malcolm and Elijah. This is the old debate laid to rest by Kwame Nkrumah when he said, seek ye first the political kingdom. or as well in the Black Manifesto, the Detroit Black Economic Development Conference of 1969, which admonished our forces to put politics in command of economics. The real debate which the black neoconservatives are trying to suppress is that which must take place between existing civil rights and electoral political leadership and the revolutionary forces within the black community. The essence of that debate is the need to inject independent black politics back into the electoral political arena. We need to follow Malcolm X on this and not Roy Ennis. The question is not either to reform the Democratic Party or join the Republican Party so as to make it responsive to our agenda. African Americans learned that the Republican Party would not respond to black needs years ago, and thus deserted that party in 1936. The Jesse Jackson phenomenon exposed the limitations of the Democratic Party to being responsive to an African American. It was for Malcolm's lead and that of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and take the electoral struggle past the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party stage, and fulfill the unfulfilled promise of the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, whose emblem was the Black Panther. In the electoral arena, we need independent black politics. The black neoconservatives are trying to replace a politics of protest with an apolitical doctrine of self-help. They are trying to disguise the true enemy of African Americans, racist United States monopoly capitalism. But they argue against the straw man. No political tendency in the black community ever opposed self-help or independent economic initiative. This is not the issue. The question is a proper relationship for politics and economics. Black neoconservatism is mounting an attack against Malcolm's doctrine of by any means necessary, because they are attempting to inject into an essentially political protest tradition an essentially economist doctrine. In his most mature period, Malcolm X left the economism of black economic nationalism behind. He was at his death attempting to fashion a new paradigm of black liberation by summing up and synthesizing the lessons of the radical black protest tradition. Black neoconservatives want to negate Malcolm and take us back over ground already tried. What we need to do is go forward to complete Malcolm's unfinished work, to construct a new paradigm of African-American liberation on the foundation he and countless others of our historical revolutionary leadership laid for us, a foundation of political Pan-African internationalism. Thank you.